Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to the Indian Religions podcast here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Nicole Karapaniadis, who is associate professor at Rutgers University. We're talking about a fascinating brand new 2021 publication, Branding Bhakti, Krishna Consciousness and the Makeover of a Movement. Nicole, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Raj. This is great. I've listened to your podcast for a while, and I've learned so much. So I'm excited to get to share today as well.
Fantastic. Now you have to tell us, how did you get to studying this? How did this all start up for you?
Well, to be quite honest, I never intended to write a book about ISKCON. Which is surprising to some people when I say that, but I, you know, I'm a scholar of North Indian Vaishnavisms and theistic Vedanta. And, you know, my earlier work has been on, digital religion. And so my, you know, my sort of the overlap there is between, you know, I'm interested in ritual studies and then also, you know, theistic Vedanta. So I've done my earlier work, was about, the sort of ontology of digital images. And so I was really interested in embodied forms of God and just really sort of, you know, just sort of taken by the question of whether or not, you know, Hindus or Hindu religious practitioners would understand forms of God or images of God that are digital to be, you know, ontologically full or ontologically real forms of God. So I did a lot of work on digital images and you know, digital ritual. So I looked at how these embodied forms of God are sort of framed online. And so I was interested in questions of, you know, how do you perform a puja on a computer and how do you frame sacred space on the computer? Are you able to, can you hear me, Raj?
Yeah, I can hear you clearly.
Oh, all right. Okay. So I've looked at, you know, questions of how do you frame ritual and sacred space and, you know, that sort of thing. So as I was doing my earlier work on digital images, I noticed that a lot of digital images of Krishna were actually posted by ISKCON groups, ISKCON devotees, ISKCON temples, whether that was on Facebook or whether that was on just different temple websites. And so this made a degree of sense to me because I thought that, by and large, Hindus believe these digital images of gods and goddesses online are full forms of God. And so I thought, well, ISKCON devotees are interested in sharing their tradition. Why not share their tradition by means of Krishna's images? So I started there. But what kind of led me to this project in particular was the fact that I started to notice that there were a lot of ISKCON websites on which images of Krishna were sort of conspicuously absent. And so as I started to sort of dig into images of Krishna, you know, posted by ISKCON devotees, I noticed that a lot of websites had no images of Krishna whatsoever. And I thought this was curious at first and became even more curious to me the more I dug around. So I would find images of people doing yoga, or people meditating, images of, you know, mountainscapes or beach sides, etc. So I was sort of struck by this, this disconnect. So I started, you know, to kind of look around even more. You know, one day I got a cold, and this is sort of how the project really got started. I had been sick for quite a while, and I hadn't really been able to work. So I thought, okay, well, one thing I can do is sit on the couch and look at images online. I can manage to do that. So I stumbled upon a number of videos by Hridayananda Das Goswami about Krishna West. And this really started to sort of trigger my mind into questions, you know, what is going on with the ISKCON movement? So here's, you know, a guru in the ISKCON movement talking about, you know, wearing polo shirts and khaki pants and not having any, you know, full sort of pujas in the temple, and sort of backing up even further. As an undergraduate, I went to the University of Florida. That's where I got my my bachelor's degrees. And I don't know if you know this, but the ISKCON movement is huge at the University of Florida. So the Hare Krishnas are a big staple on campus. They have this massive operation called Krishna Lunch, and every day they serve food to students. And when I was in college, this will probably date me a little bit, but it was like $2 or $3, and you could get a plate of just delicious vegetarian food. It was right in the Plaza of the Americas, which was this beautiful lawn right in front of the library, and the ISKCON devotees would sing, and they would play the harmonium and the mridanga drums, and it was just great. And everybody went and ate the food, and I used to go with my best friend. And I also lived next door, incidentally, to the ISKCON house in Gainesville, to the Hare Krishna house. So I had a little studio, and right across the driveway was the Hare Krishna Center. And so I had always been fascinated by them, you know, as a religious studies undergrad. I had a sort of bent about me where I was kind of a nihilist. Like, I thought this society is too mundane for me. And here are these great people next door, and they've sort of renounced this society, and they're living in their own, you know, their own religious reality. And they have this great food and this great music. So that was quite a while ago. But when I started to see these websites where Krishna's images were absent, and kind of seeing videos and new sort of yoga studios and meditation studios, I started to really wonder, like, what has happened to the ISKCON movement? Has it changed so much since I was an undergrad, and sort of what's going on? So I started to dig. That's really the root of the project, and trying to uncover, you know, what these differences meant and what produced them. I also, you know, I consider myself very much a storyteller in the kind of work I do. And, you know, the more I started to ask questions of particularly the gurus who are doing these rebrandings of the movement, I just detected, you know, a lot of pain in their voices. And just, they would talk about wanting to accomplish certain things in their lives that they hadn't been able to do, and that they were nearing the end of their lives, and they really wanted to do important work, and this work was important to them. And I thought, I think these are some stories that I need to tell. So
there are definitely stories you need to tell. There are definitely stories you've told. And why don't you give us a bit of a sneak preview? I was initially going to next ask you about the layout of the book. You can start with that if you want. But really, the burning question for all of us is, what is the nature of this makeover? You know, what are the strategies of this rebranding? You know, answer that however you feel fit.
So I guess I can kind of talk about, you know, the nature of the rebranding first. You know, in the structure of the book, which I can talk about, you know, afterwards in more detail. But, you know, the overarching, I would say, nature of the rebranding is an attempt to make the ISKCON movement more global than it already is. And so there's a real desire on the part of the individuals whom I call the Krishna branders to do outreach for people who, you know, who they define as Westerners. And I try to problematize that term in my book. So, you know, they use the term Westerners essentially to mean, you know, anyone who is not of Indian descent. And, you know, they sort of have this idea that ISKCON is naturally attractive to Indian Hindus, but that Prabhupada, Swami Prabhupada, the founder of the movement, you know, and his gurus who preceded him really wanted the movement to be a global movement or a sort of world religion. And so they, those individuals in the book, whom I call the Krishna Branders, are really trying to aim to make the movement more global, to attract a wider audience of people. So they're rebranding the movement in different ways, but trying to sort of make ISKCON a more sort of, well, this is a sort of tricky part here. Are they trying to make ISKCON a more meditation-based movement or a more sort of yoga-based movement? Or are they trying to make ISKCON, you know, seem to be a more meditation-based or more yoga-based movement, right? So part of what it means, you know, to rebrand something or to brand something is, you know, branding is about storytelling, right? And it's about meaning making. And so, you know, branding is really about not really about who we are, but who do we want others to think we are, right? That's the sort of definition, I would say, one of them, of sort of branding. So I think that the overarching project is to try to draw people to the ISKCON movement by rebranding it as meditation or by rebranding it as yoga. So to sort of draw in a wider audience of people.
Could you say a bit about the agency of this rebranding? Is this sort of a movement that folks are swept up in that's an instinctive response? Is it sort of based on some kind of conscious committee work at the upper echelons of ISKCON? Is this a grassroots response? You know, what is the agency of the surrounding?
That's a good question. So it's in pockets of the ISKCON movement. So, you know, it's being led. So in my book, I talk about the stories of three gurus in particular, all of whom were initial, devotees of Swami Prabhupada himself, and are also members of ISKCON's GBC, which is the sort of governing body of the movement. So I would say that it's not entirely a grassroots kind of movement, but it is also something that is at the upper levels of the movement's management. But that being said, these gurus that I profile in this book are very popular ISKCON gurus who happen to have a lot of disciples around the world. So this is a movement, this is something that is being done in India. It's something that's being done in the United States. It's being done, you know, in New Zealand, in Australia. So they've inspired a number of devotees to work on their behalf to produce this movement. So I would say it's both. You know, I think one of the interesting things about the ISKCON movement that I've learned, it is, in my view, a very, you know, evangelizing form of Hinduism. And, you know, whether or not ISKCON is Hinduism is itself, a sort of contested question. But it is a very, you know, evangelical movement. And so, you know, the founders of the movement inspired their disciples to spread the movement on their behalf. And so there's a lot of leeway that devotees get in order to accomplish this. And so in some ways it is grassroots. You know, there were many, many times when I was traveling around the United States or in India where it did seem like people were just sort of coming up with ideas and thinking, this would be great. This is a great idea for a program. Let's do it. So it's not really so much of a top-down entirely. It's sort of both. I'm not sure, does that answer your question? Did you want?
Yeah, questions are always scenic route, sort of generative to spark conversation. So yeah, there's lots of content there. In terms of this evangelical thrust, currently, how to say, what do you see, who do you see as the primary target now? Has it changed? Is it typically for Westerners interested in Indian spirituality, for Hindus who want to learn more about their tradition, for Vaishnavas in particular? Like, I have no specific answer in mind, but what would you say in response to that?
So the ISKCON movement in general, is that sort of broadly
Yes,
speaking?
Yes. who's it targeted to in terms of this rebranding, do you feel, or have you found?
So this rebranding in particular that I talk about in this book is, geared toward Westerners. And I should qualify that term. So that is the term that that devotees themselves use. It's not the term I myself would use. But, by Westerners, ISKCON devotees mean just everyone who is not of Indian descent, right? And this is a term that that I've heard all devotees use. I mean, I've heard devotees use this in India as well, which is not something I was expecting. So I went to a number of temples in India, in Juhu, in Chaupati, in Delhi. And, this is a term that, this is something also that I was interested in the project. But so I think they're interested in attracting a global base of devotees outside of India. And so I should qualify this. The reason they want to do this is because they feel that they've already been very successful in India. So it's not the case that they're trying to, change the constituency of the movement to only have, people from, say, everywhere else, right? They feel that they've been very successful in India and with the Indian community around the world, which is something that was striking to me, because when I first started to talk to ISKCON devotees and gurus, I thought, well, why are you rebranding? You're doing so well. Like I went to, when I was first working on my project on digital images, I went to, ISKCON in Delhi and ISKCON in Vrindavan. And the lines to get in the temple were just miles long for some of the festivals. And they were so jam-packed, and there were so many great devotees. There were so many great programs. The temples were always busy. And so I thought to myself, like, that's strange, because I thought that people who do rebranding because things are not going well, but this certainly seems that things are going incredibly well. So, what I learned is that kind of by tracing it back historically, which is what the Krishna branders do, they're really trying to attract just a broader group of people. And so they'll use the example, of other world religions, for example, that are not, region specific. So they'll talk about, traditions like Islam, for example, that are, they're converts from all different cultural groups to Islam, that talk about Christianity. So I think the real desire is to make the ISKCON movement a world religious tradition, right, as they understand that, just like other traditions that are so-called. So, one thing I really found interesting about this project, because, to be honest, I wasn't sure what to make of this desire to attract, Westerners, so to speak, to the movement. I wasn't sure how to think about this. I'm a historian. I'm familiar with sort of colonial sort of discourses and colonial traditions in India. So I was a little bit troubled by this. This outreach in many ways. But, as I dug sort of historically, I realized that, the sort of very sort of foundational ideas of ISKCON have always been about trying to have a global movement. So the second chapter of my book really looks back to, devotees would trace it all the way back to Chaitanya himself. But I look at, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who was, an Indian religious thinker whose primary ideas were really about how can he make Vaishnavism universal, and that was the sort of primary aim that he had. So he wanted to, and part of this had to do with colonial influence. And so I think Bhaktivinoda Thakur was a, Hindu reformer, just like other figures, we might say someone like Ram Mohan Roy. But he was a more sort of theistic type of reformer. But he wanted to make Vaishnavism universal as he understood it, and passed it along to his son, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, whose main sort of idea was to bring his understanding of Vaishnavism, to the West, so to speak. Right. So there was always, even in the figures and traditions that predated the ISKCON movement, that were in the ISKCON lineage, I would say that the primary role of them was always to become global, right? So even in, you know, ISKCON devotees' understandings of Chaitanya himself. So, you know, many Vaishnavas understand Chaitanya to be, you know, a form of Krishna who came into the sort of human body in order to experience love of Krishna through his own form, right? So to come as an individual who can experience love of Krishna wanting to experience himself. But ISKCON devotees often talk about Chaitanya as a figure who came not just to experience love of Krishna, but also to spread love of Krishna. Right? So even in interpretations of central figures, central texts, so we could look at the Bhagavad Gita, and I forget the exact verse, but I believe it's in the 18th chapter. You know, there's a passage where Krishna talks about devotees that are the most special to him. And, you know, I heard a number of times ISKCON devotees interpret this text to mean that those devotees who, you know, distribute Swami Prabhupada's literature are most dear to Krishna. So, you know, one thing I wanted to show in this book was that this sort of drive to outreach, global outreach, is really at the core of the movement. And so I think that what the Krishna branders are doing, and by Krishna branders, you know, the figures who are trying to attract a global audience by rebranding the movement, can really be understood as trying to extend that project.
Yeah, earlier, you mentioned, okay, well, things are going so well. Why the need for a rebrand? And it seems to be the case then the metric for success is how robust ISKCON is among a quote unquote Western audience, then it seems. Would you say that's accurate?
I think in a number of ISKCON circles, that's accurate. You know, and so, you know, I should sort of, you know, I mean, I think the sort of elephant in the room is this, well, what is a Westerner, right? What does that even mean? And so I think, you know, by the term Westerner, I have heard, you know, the Krishna branders refer to people in Japan, for example, or in China or in Australia or, you know, wherever it might be, not just in, you know, in terms of like, you know, Europe, or not just in terms of the United States. But I think the history of this term really does go back to the sort of colonial roots, where Westerner was initially understood as groups of people who seem more sort of ethnically, racially, culturally like the British. But that's not the way the term is used now. So if we kind of qualify it and say that what devotees mean by Westerner is really just global, which I do believe is their use of the term, then yes, I think that the goal of the movement is to try to attract a global audience. So this is not to say that there aren't, you know, disagreements about this within the movement. I'm certainly not trying to paint a picture that ISKCON is a, you know, a monolith, or that there's only one, you know, kind of view on this. But I would say that a very large goal of a very large number of ISKCON devotees is to try to attract a global audience, which is, you know, what's kind of at the root of these rebranding, you know, places and websites that I talk about. This is not to say that all ISKCON devotees have this view. Certainly not the case. There's many who think we're doing just fine. We're doing great. But I do think that, you know, that there is a concern, I think, to maintain, you know, Swami Prabhupada's initial vision. But also, I think there's some concern that if they don't keep this up and try to do sort of global outreach, that the movement might, you know, kind of dwindle in terms of, you know, its relevance. So it's a sort of existential soul searching, I think, is the kind of moment I've captured. Or have tried to capture.
Yeah, it seems that in many ways, various religious traditions are grappling with this ever-shifting world in different ways, ISKCON being no exception. Of course, it's a unique tradition that's that is addressing the pressures of modernity and globalization in very unique ways. Why don't you tell us about the chapter-to-chapter structure of the book?
So I start off, the introduction just sort of talks about, kind of raises the questions that I liked, that I'm looking at in the book. And the main overarching question of the book is, how do religious groups rebrand themselves in order to attract a more diverse, range of participants? And so how do religious groups recast their messages, to the sort of tastes and interests and existential, preferences of different groups of people, wider groups of people? So that's kind of the bigger issue that I'm looking at. And this is a very common, position across religious groups. So you can look at a number of religious figures, not very related to ISKCON. So somebody, like Joel Osteen, for example, who in many ways can be understood as a religious figure who has rebranded in Christianity, to reach out to audiences who are interested in, rebuilding themselves after hardship or after struggle, or kind of retaining hope in the midst of difficult circumstances. And so we see this, with Buddhist mindfulness. There's a number of groups that are sort of rebranding Buddhist traditions as sort of mindful movements in order to capture the interests and tastes and preferences of a wide group of people. So it's not the ISKCON movement alone that's doing this. It's a trend that's happening around the world. It's been happening for a really long time. And I think, in many ways, it's happening in areas outside of religion too. I think just in the humanities now, right? We're sort of faced with this question of the humanities, unfortunately, sadly, are not doing well in this, just universities and academic life in general. And so I think these sort of questions about, well, how can we sort of reframe what we do in the humanities to attract, the attention not only of students, but also of university administrators and funding sources. So I think these questions are just bigger than ISKCON. So that's my sort of introduction, raises that. The second chapter, I go into some detail kind of asking this question about why is it that the ISKCON movement wants to rebrand at all, right? They're doing very well. I sort of talk about the numbers. I talk a little bit about the history of the decline of the ISKCON movement, at least in the United States, in terms of devotees. So there were a number and I don't want to spend too much time on this because I think too much has been written about these lawsuits in some sense. But there were a number of lawsuits that the ISKCON movement faced, that were settled in the 80s and 90s. And the movement just lost a lot of money. And they also, there was, with the anti-cult movement scares, around the same time, they lost some bit of, clout, I think, in the public eye. And so there were a number of sort of events that happened in the United States that sort of caused the ISKCON movement to decline financially and in terms of perceived legitimacy, right? And so I talk about those as sort of setting the sort of sociological stage for wanting, to do this rebranding. But the second chapter, looks back at the history, trying to contextualize the Krishna branders, who are the individuals who are rebranding the movement in order to attract a more global audience. And so I look at figures like Bhaktivinod Thakur, I look at figures like Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati. And I also look at textual verses that the Krishna branders themselves raised as the sort of central component of their mission. So, there's this a particular verse that I talk about at length that devotees cite, from the Padyavali of Rupa Goswami. They talk about, wanting to be the servant of the servant of the servant of Krishna. And so wanting, being a part of ISKCON is not just worshiping Krishna and, relishing that devotion, but also sharing that with others as a sort of primary sort of mission. So I talk about how that particular, drive to serve the gurus and their mission. I trace that from the original figures to Prabhupada himself, Swami Prabhupada, and then kind of trace that to when he came to the United States in 1965 and how he passed that on to his own disciples. So, one thing I try to do in that chapter is connect the history of ISKCON in the United States with its sort of foundational roots in India. I think often in scholarship on ISKCON, there's people talk about one or the other, right? So there's great scholarship on the ISKCON movement, after Swami Prabhupada left India to spread the movement around the world. So there's great work on, ISKCON in the UK, and there's great work in ISKCON, in Ghana and in the United States. And then there's great work on sort of foundational movements and figures who predated the sort of formal ISKCON movement in India. But there's not a lot of work that kind of connects the two. And in my mind, they're intrinsically tied. I don't think that you can really understand, diaspora ISKCON, if I could call it that, if you don't look at the, Indian historical context of the ISKCON movement. So I try to do that in the second chapter. The third, fourth, and fifth chapters are the sort of substantive chapters of the brands. And so we could talk about these in more detail, but, I look at, I take the fact that, okay, given that these Krishna branders have this as the reason, for wanting to rebrand the movement, how exactly do they do that? Right. So they want to attract Westerners, so-called. They want to do this on behalf of their guru. So how exactly do they do that? So in the third chapter, I look at the sort of brands and the apparatus, I could say, of Devamrita Swami, who is an ISKCON guru who is based in New Zealand and travels around New Zealand, Australia, but also around the United States and Canada, actually. I think he has or I think it's since closed, but there was a lounge that he opened up in Toronto, where you are. So he came up with an idea for rebranding of ISKCON that his position was essentially that the ISKCON movement cannot attract Westerners, as he would call them, or just a global audience, I prefer to say, if it is presented to them in temples. And this was a controversial position. Like I was uncomfortable with this, talking to these gurus, and I pressed them a lot. This is something that was uncomfortable for me. What do you mean? How is this not a just extension of the colonial project, And they were great. I mean, they, as just interlocutors, the ISKCON gurus were really, I was quite bashful to ask these questions at first, because I thought, if I say that, they're going to kick me off this project. Like, they're going to tell me, look, stop researching us. I'm not answering your questions anymore. But I really pressed them hard. I thought, well, what do you mean you're going to present this movement to people outside of the temple? So, but Devamrita Swami came up with this idea, which he calls a bridge or a bridge program, which essentially means that you present ISKCON in what he calls lounges and lofts. So he builds in New Zealand and Australia. There's one in Fishtown in Philadelphia, near where I live, in Toronto, these centers that are meditation studios and yoga studios. And you walk in and it looks nothing like an ISKCON temple. There's a couch, there's some yoga mats. They have programs on sustainability and on cooking and yoga and mindfulness. And you wouldn't know it was an ISKCON center if you didn't know it was an ISKCON center. And so he built this framework where, if you present ISKCON to people in a way that sort of obscures the fact that it's a temple-based movement in many ways, then they will become attracted to this rebranded form and then ultimately become attracted to the sort of, you know, kind of mainline ISKCON, if I can use that term, right? So his idea was that there's, and his use is it's a transcendental on-ramp. So so that, you know, you can have to take a transcendental on-ramp. Those are not my words, those are his words. But, you know, and the ramp is the lounge or the loft program, so the yoga, the meditation. And then that ramp leads you to ultimately the destination, which is the ISKCON temple. I'll kind of move through this quickly. I'm sure you have some sort of questions for me here. So that's kind of the framework that he developed. The second chapter, I look at the brands of Radhanath Swami, who is a world, you know, sort of world renowned ISKCON guru, who is rebranding the ISKCON movement as yoga. So he does a number of, you know, kind of theological interpretive moves to place surrender and devotion to Krishna as the primary goal of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. And so he gives a lot of sort of lectures and sermons about how devotion to Krishna is the main goal of the Yoga Sutras, and then has built a number of really successful yoga studios in Manhattan, which is a pretty high-end yoga market from what I understand. And they're real yoga class. I mean, I'm not really into yoga, but I went to a few of the classes just as part of the ethnography for my book, and they're hard. There's a lot of people. They're doing yoga, they're doing inversions and you know, headstands and all of it. And sort of builds this yoga brand as a way to draw people in to the ISKCON movement. So it uses the same sort of framework as the bridge model. And then the last chapter looks at a different approach to attracting a global audience. So this is the new sort of startup, if we can call it, a new ISKCON startup called Krishna West. And this is a movement or sub-movement, I should say, started by Hridayananda Das Goswami. And he basically makes the argument that you can't just make a sort of bridge to the ISKCON movement. So you can't present people with yoga and meditation studios and then expect them to then make a turn and join the ISKCON movement, you know, that's rooted in temples. So he says, you know, you should just create a new sub-movement of ISKCON. So not a new ISKCON movement. I feel like I need to be very clear about that. He's not trying to make a different movement, but a movement within ISKCON that basically, you know, is what he would call the core of the tradition. And, you know, conceptions of the core, shifting goalposts, and we don't really talk about it like that in religious studies, but his understanding of the core of the movement is that it's just the teachings and the food and the chanting, and everything else can be scrapped. So, you know, he's starting up centers where people chant the mantras of ISKCON. They read the text of ISKCON. They offer food to Krishna, but they do so in spaces that don't look like temples. They do so, you know, wearing not dhotis and not saris, but wearing, you know, khaki pants and polo shirts and, I don't know, other sort of forms of dress that might be appealing to them. Guitars are used, people serve food like pizza. So it's really just about, I think even within ISKCON, there's this internal debate about whether the best way to draw people in is to present them with something that's a rebranded form and use that to sort of draw them into the temples, or whether the temples just need to sort of be re-envisioned. So there's a lot of questions here, you know, a lot of questions here. What is the ISKCON movement if it's outside of temples? And what does this mean for, you know, worship of Krishna in embodied forms, and how innovative is too innovative, and how are devotees going to receive these, and all these sorts of questions I take up in the conclusion.
Yeah, there's so much data there. That's fascinating on a number of levels. All of these rebranders, as you call them, are they all swamis within the ISKCON movement?
Yes.
And do you know if they have conversations with each other about their very different visions of the future of ISKCON?
My sense is that they do. I think that, you know, I think they share more than they sort of disagree on. So I think they all, share ideas about kind of doing outreach. I think that the biggest sort of rift would be, I would say, between the sort of Krishna West approach and the approach of the other gurus. So, I think that, but even then, I know that they are all friends, as far as I was able to tell. And they do, respect each other, and also sort of more traditional approaches too. So this is not, a lot of people would kind of see this and think that, there's a sort of tension in the ISKCON movement. And I don't think they see it that way. I think that there are perhaps other members of the ISKCON community who might see it that way. So these figures have been controversial even within the movement. But at least amongst themselves, they see themselves to be sort of attracting different market segments, if you will, right? So this is a book about marketing, and I studied the sort of supply side of this. And they do understand there to be different market segments. And so they're sort of trying to attract specific groups of people within a larger ISKCON umbrella. And so, I think in that regard, they do share ideas and sort of share a vision about this.
Would they think of what they're doing as branding consciously? Or is that a term that's being used for the sake of the discussion in the book?
So that's a term that I use. That's the sort of theoretical lens that I'm using. I don't think they would look at it as branding. The chapter 3 of the book, I talk about Dave Amritaswamy and his bridge program and his models. I think he would use the term branding, if not marketing. So he's very, he's just very smart. He went to Yale, and he's very well studied on sort of business models. And it talks very openly about this. And so he does, he has studied, marketing and branding, and he uses language of marketing and branding. So he talks about, how do you get someone from being a cold contact to a warm contact, right? That's the language of marketing right there. So how do you get somebody who knows nothing about the ISKCON movement? How do you get them to warm up to the movement and want to know more? He talks about loss leaders, and that's the term he uses, right? So a loss leader is like, when you go to, like Best Buy. I don't know if Best Buy open anymore. I don't even know what's open anymore because everything's closed with the pandemic. But if you go to a store like Best Buy, they might give away like free printer ink because they want you to buy a printer. And so he talks about these kind of examples as he talks about ISKCON. So he says, we build, meditation studios, and we build these rebranded centers because we want to draw in people who might not otherwise be interested in the ISKCON movement. And so he talks about actively, how can we reach people who might not know that much about the movement? How can we sort of appeal to them? And so I think he might use that language. I don't think Radhanath Swami would use that language. I asked him directly, I think part of the issue here too is, this question of, because I've been asked this question a lot, whether or not they use the term branding themselves. And I think there's some discomfort with the term branding, because I think it seems to imply to some people a sort of deception, right? Or a sort of maybe a monetary interest, or, just some sort of ulterior motive. And the gurus and the Krishna branders that I worked with in this book don't have that as an intention, right? I think, and I hope I don't come across as saying something otherwise, but I think they just very sincerely have this tradition that they really want to share with people. And they find themselves in this position that, you know, lots of the groups that they're trying to get to come to the ISKCON temple just are not maybe naturally interested in or don't really know that much about kind of theistic temple worship. And so they're really trying to introduce the movement to people in ways that might catch their interest. And so I think that would be how they would put it. That is how they put it, rather than in terms of branding, right? So there's this you know, term they would use, something like, you know, yukta vairagya, which is using, you know, items and articles and ideas in the world in the service of Krishna. So they would say that, you know, they're using things like yoga and using things like meditation in order to bring people to the ISKCON movement. So that would be the language that they would use, not, you know, so much about branding. But it's an interesting question. You know, one of the things I sort of, I'll stop there for now.
Yeah, it's a fascinating question and fascinating tension. A very recent interview we've had on the podcast was of Jacob Kyle, who was the founder of a platform called Embodied Philosophy. Mm-hmm. He has a yoga and spirituality background, and he now has a very thriving online platform that offers courses and subscriptions and various other services that are for purchase. And so we had this conversation where he albeit for an online modern endeavor, really reacts to the idea of branding and sort of the language of sales and marketing, and yet he accepts that that is what it is. And it's so interesting because I think shorn of the stigmas and the associations of the language of sales and marketing implicated in manipulation, exploitation. Really, it's a powerful lens. I remember I got to be the first world religions prof. I was a sessional at Ryerson University in 2017.
Okay.
Downtown Toronto, world's most diverse city, you know, statistically. And so part of the frame of teaching world religions that I found effective with the students was through the lens of sales and marketing. What's each tradition selling? What does it cost you? What do you have to give up for it? Right? How is it being positioned, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It was a fascinating sort of thought experiment. So that's why I had to ask the question about the branding.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's an awesome approach. Actually, I like that. You know, at the end of the day, I think religions are, you know, sort of amorphous, rhetorical products. Here I am using the language of marketing again. But, you know, I mean, they're sort of rhetorical discourses, and they're shaped by people and by actors who are, you know, acting with particular interests. This has always been the case, right, for various audiences and in different contexts. And so I don't know, for me at least, I think that religions as rhetorical discourses have always been marketed and branded, right? I don't think this is anything new. I think we can sort of look at this historically as well. That's my take on it.
Without question. I mean, think of the idea of the marketplace of ideas that's always existed. All religions are selling you something or selling you on something, whether it's your own potential, whether it's a vision of humanity, whether it's a means of salvation, whether it's, you know, some sort of template for conducting your life as a human being. They have something or many somethings that are being sold. Right. Yeah. And that doesn't necessarily mean they're being sold in an underhanded, exploitative manner. But nevertheless, there's something on sale from every world religion, yeah, without question. So conclusions, what does one take away from this fascinating research of yours?
You know, I think in some ways I think there's a number of questions to take away rather than necessarily a number of answers. I mean, you know, I think, and questions, I mean, questions for the ISKCON communities in general. I think really what's at stake in this work, you know, is sort of what's to come of this. I think there's a number of existential questions that are important for the ISKCON movement. You know, one of the questions that I sort of take up in this book, that is not just my question, but questions that are being asked in the movement as well, you know, kind of has to do with, you know, what's the core of ISKCON? And, well, just to kind of say it, you know, a lot of people hear this sort of traditions and the sort of groups and not groups, but sort of new centers that I write about, and they think, well, isn't that deception, right? So this is a question that just comes up. You know, is the ISKCON movement trying to position itself as yoga and meditation in order to get new converts? Or, I mean, you know, is it really yoga and meditation? And so I think, and this is a hard question, and I asked this question so many times, and it was one of those questions where I thought, surely they're going to kick me out at this point if I ask them. I mean, I remember I interviewed Radhanath Swami, who is this very famous guru. He's very humble, and I was so anxious, and I thought, I have to ask, you know, is this, do you think this is deception, or what might someone think if they thought it was deception? I was very nervous. And he was very adamant, as all the Krishna branders were, that, that no, it's not deception. We are offering, you know, yoga, and we are offering meditation, and that these are just ways to sort of broaden our community. So I think the real question is, you know, what is ISKCON? I think is really what's at stake here. So for people who are sort of, you know, so Radhanath Swami brought up this idea of, you know, simultaneous, you know, difference and non-difference, that, you know, we can be both yoga and meditation and temple ISKCON, and they can coexist together, and there can be multiple ISKCONs under one rubric. And that's the sort of society that Swami Prabhupada himself envisioned. On one end of the spectrum, there are sort of purists who might say that, you know, the only real ISKCON, so to speak, would be ISKCON in the temples. ISKCON that's sort of based in these, you know, puja and arati, and offering food and sort of Sunday feasts. And on the other end of the spectrum, you know, are people who would be sort of more interested in these branding projects. And so the idea really is, can they coexist together? And what does that mean for the ISKCON identity? One of my main conclusions for this book that I really wanted readers to take home, you know, is that the ISKCON landscape has radically changed. So scholarship on ISKCON is still really focused on ISKCON in the temples. Not just residential ISKCON, but even just sort of ISKCON devotees who have moved outside of the temples, who attend, you know, programs at the temples. But still, the temple is the focus of much of the scholarship on ISKCON. But the ISKCON landscape has changed a lot. The ISKCON landscape now includes meditation studios and yoga lounges and eco farms and, you know, vision boarding classes and karate classes and, you know, you name it, guitar classes, you name it, they're there. And so we can't really talk about the ISKCON movement in the same way. We need new maps. We need new schemas and frameworks for understanding the ISKCON movement. And one way I think that we need to do that, or the best way we can do that, in my view, you know, is through the lens of marketing, to really understand why these new centers came about, who they're geared for, you know, just to look at the diversity of the sort of ISKCON topography, so to speak. But I think the conclusions are that the landscape is radically different than it was. You know, the ISKCON movement is not just, you know, Rath Yatras on the streets anymore of, you know, major cities. It's that, and it's also a number of other programs. And so devotees themselves need to reconcile, you know, what is ISKCON? And how do we accommodate these differences? And I think scholars need to do the same.
Yeah, anecdotally, it was clear to me that a major shift was taking place from my sort of minimal exposure, in that I was invited to some social gatherings by some colleagues who were connected to ISKCON. This was early 2000s. And for me personally, I certainly felt it was palpable to me that there was a level of expectation and pressure in the air with respect to the adopting of ideas or the seeing or the experiencing of what was felt to be important. And let's see, that would have been to maybe 15 years later, 2017, I took my Ryerson class to a field trip to the ISKCON temple for a variety of reasons, to learn about a variety of, you know, there's so many angles through which you can interpret such an experience. And my goodness, was I pleasantly surprised at the radical shift and relaxing of the pressure of processization, which was non-existent. It was very much a welcoming guided tour. And of course, at the end, there was a kirtan in which people could participate if they wanted to or not. Yeah. And it was sort of like, we're leaving the dessert on the table. You want to have a taste? Be our guest. You don't? Hare Krishna, we're in Toronto. Go where you need to go for whatever you need to go. You know, it was, so it's, this is just, you know, minor anecdotal data, I guess. I've joked many times on this podcast, I have no idea how I became a textual scholar. I just love observing experiences and people so much. It's just so bizarre. Anyhow, the book is so fascinating on so many levels. 30,000 foot view, it seems that, you know, this is an ancient enterprise. What to do upon the death of the founder of a major religious movement, a new religious movement. And take a look at all of the world's religions where we have access to even scant data. Folks scramble what's canon, what's practice, what, you know, it needs to evolve to survive. And yet, the times through which we live are unique, to say the least. And so the ways in which ISKCON is able to adapt, I think it's really unprecedented in terms of the maneuverability afforded by the times through which we live.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and I think that the times are different. When Swami Prabhupada came here, there was a much more of a sort of cultural interest, I would say, in sort of new guru movements. That's not really here as much as it is as now as it was then. So I think, you know, the ISKCON devotees are sort of struggling, you know, with this. With, you know, the times are very different, just economically, socially, etc. But it's a perennial question, I think. You know, every so when the founders of religions pass, you know, and I keep, you know, kind of bringing back the sort of state of higher ed, which is just something I'm thinking about a lot. You know, I recently became the department chair like a month ago. So I'm thinking about all these sorts of questions, right, about identity. But
congratulations.
Saying, well, I'm not sure.
Or my condolences. Congratulations.
Thanks. Thank you. But, you know, just sort of how do we reach students? How do we interest students in the humanities? What are some novel ways we can do that without losing who we are? And these are complicated questions. I think these are the questions that the ISKCON devotees are struggling with even today, you know, how you have to, you know, sort of adapt and reshape yourselves if you don't want to become, you know, completely irrelevant, whether that's a religious group or a, you know, a subject that's studied in a university. But at the same time, you don't want to become, there's a fine line between sort of reshaping and pandering. And I think this is something that religious communities themselves struggle with. So if you reshape too much, then if you kind of cross over into sort of pandering to the crowd, then you lose some sort of identity. And how do you navigate that in a space like a world that we're living in now? I think that the Krishna branders are just ultimately trying, you know, with a purity of intention, I would say. And I do want to stress that, just really trying to say, like, you know, how can they reach people? You know, they have this love of Krishna. They want to share it with others. How can they do it in a way that is going to attract people's interest? You know, and I think in some, you know, I think that's really what they're doing. I think there's some recognition that ISKCON temples, you know, are sort of foreign spaces to many, you know, people, just in terms of language, right? So there's a lot of, I've been to a number of ISKCON temples, you know, where the speaker will speak in Hindi, for example. And I think even just on basic levels, right, they're trying to kind of broaden the movement out to, if there were to be, you know, an American student or, you know, somebody who doesn't speak Hindi, how would they try to, you know, reach out to them? So I think they're just trying to broaden the scope on a number of different levels.
Yeah, the word that keeps coming to mind in the back of my mind is bridging. Yeah. And there's so much of what's happening that's fascinating that I can't relate to at all in terms of my personal experience. Mm-hmm. And yet there's so much that I relate to very much in terms of bridging scholarly findings and public accessibility or public interest or framing the things we do at the Academy in ways in which that showcase the relevance or the meaning, the significance of why we bother spending X years trying to figure this thing out. But, you know, more and more I'm thinking of this online school that I have. It's called the School of Indian Wisdom. And those are the questions. To what extent are you presenting wisdom teachings and or scholarship in a way that's authentic to you and your tradition and your training, which is of paramount importance? And at the same time, making darn sure that you are reaching who you need to reach with the quote-unquote branding, with the titles, with the concepts, with the outreach. And so it really is fascinating. There has long been a connection in the back of my brain since about 2016 between the language and the enterprise of marketing and the ancient tradition of selling religion. Right. So I think it's an apt lens. Is there anything else about the book that you wanted to share or touch on?
I think I've touched on most of the things I wanted to talk about. I'm sure once I stop the interview, I'll think about a million things I wanted to say.
This is just an appetizer, right?
Just an appetizer. Yeah, you know, I think there's a lot more work to be done, honestly. I wish that I could have done a lot more. I think this is just a really ripe area, but.
Well, it seems to me that the best books are beginnings rather than conclusions. And it's clear to me that the ISKCON movement will only diversify in its intention to survive and fulfill its mission of reaching a global audience in a variety of ways. And I suspect there'll be a number of studies on that in coming years and decades. Well, thank you for appearing on the podcast today.
Thanks so much for having me. This was great.
Fantastic. For those of you listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Nicole Karapaniotis, who is associate professor at Rutgers University. We've been speaking about her brand new 2021 Indiana University Press publication, Branding Bhakti, Krishna Consciousness, and the Makeover of a Movement. Until next time, stay safe, stay well, keep listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating the dynamism of religious movements. Take care.
Thanks, Raj.